often people fail to realize the depth of the opposition. So I would say we've got to understand what we're facing. The French Revolution only lasted 10 years in France. But like a volcanic explosion, the lava flow has flowed out ever since.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Freedom Featured. I'm your host, Barry Bussey. With me today, we have Oz Guinness, who's an author and a person who's been very much watching what's happening in the culture, very interested in religious freedom. And Oz, it's a great pleasure to have you on this program.
Well, thank you, Barry. My privilege to be on with you.
Well, you know, Oz, as we look around the world, there's a lot of tension. I've been following some of the writings, for example, of Neil Howe recently saying that the fourth turning is here. And, you know, where he's predicting that there's going to be, we're in a time of upheaval now in society at large. You have written so much about religious freedom and the importance of sitting down and having dialogue. And I'm just, what is your sense of the state of the world and certainly of the West today?
Well, I'm personally not a fan of Neil Howe because I don't believe in the cyclical view of history. Okay. But I do think we're in an extraordinary moment. I would prefer to see it in terms of Christopher Dawson, the great Catholic historian, who had the notion of a civilizational moment. In other words, every civilization has an inspiration, a dynamic by which it rises. But at a certain point in history, each civilization loses touch with its inspiration. And at that moment, there are only three broad options: renewal, replacement, or decline. And of course, all the great civilizations of history are either in ruins or in history books or museums. In other words, they faced that moment and took the wrong turning. And I think that's where the West is today. So there's no question that the West is the child of Christendom, of the Jewish and Christian faiths. Now, if you take that seriously, obviously anyone who takes faith seriously takes freedom of religion and conscience seriously. Because you absolutely need freedom of religion and conscience if you're to have a free society. And yet that's in crisis today, too.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And there's a number of areas where we see that happening. Like there's, a lot of people, we've come through the pandemic. There was a lot of people have been, saying that there's been a crisis of conscience and how society been able to deal with it. And then you've got the public side, the public health people saying, well, no, this is not an issue of conscience and that kind of stuff. That was a big debate. But we've got other issues, issues that go to a deep level, it seems to me, in our culture. Things like medical assistance in dying, which, of course, is a euphemism for, euthanasia. And then you've got other issues, abortion and so forth, and the structure of the family. All of these things seem to be unraveling in one form or another throughout the West.
Sadly, you're exactly right. Now, if we protect and guarantee religious freedom, it is the inner forum, in other words, in each person's heart and mind and conscience, but it should balance the outer forum of a civil public square. So when you've got religious freedom guaranteed and you've got civility in the public square, you can have full-throated debate as you really should have in a vital democracy. Now, I'm not American, but I'm living in this country. And I first got into this many, many years ago when I happened to write a one-page memo to myself on the genius of the First Amendment in American history. And it, through a series of luck, accidents, through my wife at a swimming lesson for our then three-year-old son, it fell into the hands of a senator who gave it to the Chief Justice, and I got a call from the Chief Justice inviting me for lunch.
Wow.
And I'll never forget it, because he said to me, he said, this is about the time of the bicentennial of the Constitution. Mm. He said, we've got millions of dollars donated to celebrating free speech, but almost nothing on freedom of religion and conscience. Mm. What would you suggest? Now, I suggested what became the Williamsburg Charter, a statement on American religious liberty.
Right.
What you can see, Barry, though, is that for 300 years here in America, freedom of religion and conscience was the first liberty, as the framers put it. But in the last 20 years, there's been a sea change. I call it the three dark R's. You've got on first the reducers who've made freedom of religion just a matter of freedom of worship. And Obama did that, and Hillary Clinton did that. Disastrous. Every dictator will grant you freedom of worship. In other words, what you believe between your ears, you keep your mouth shut at home. Mm. That is not religious freedom. And then you had the really dangerous one, which I call the rebranders. Mm. And they have come out of the radical left and, of course, the cultural Marxist agenda. And for them, religious freedom is a code word for bigotry. So that's the main attack in this country, and I imagine in Canada, as it is in Britain, too. They've changed the whole notion. So originally, the three great freedoms, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, were the political rights that you needed, like air and water for the body. Mm. And no free society can flourish without them. Mm. But now suddenly, the whole Western tradition is being gaslighted, and religious freedom, a code word for bigotry and discrimination. So we're in a very vital fight for religious freedom and for freedom of speech.
You know, it's interesting because I've done some writing in this area, and I looked at it as a legal revolution against the accommodation of religion in Canada, where we had a consensus in years past that the government would accommodate religion. Government actors would accommodate religion. It was expected that even in the private realm, there would be an accommodation of religion, allowing people to have their days of worship off, allowing people to wear their religious clothing, those kinds of things. And as you point out, we have seen in the last, certainly in the last two decades, and I agree with you, it's really come on heavy, where any type of religious freedom was seen as you said, a bigotry. What I've often saw here is the argument, well, really, religious freedom is really saying that you're claiming a right to discriminate, is a lot of the language you hear with the academics in Canada. And we saw that in spades when a religious university, Christian university out in British Columbia, wanted to have a law school. And just because they maintained a definition of marriage as one man and one woman, the law societies across the country, three in particular, Ontario, Nova Scotia, and British Columbia, said they would not accept any graduate from that school to write the bar exams, to sit in the bar exams and practice law in the province. And at the end of the day, you look at it and you say, well, okay, so why would you prevent that? And the only thing that I could come to was the idea of one person of a group that was presenting in court was basically just knowing that such a school exists offends me. And it's like, well, is that a reason enough to deny, you know, the religious freedom of the Christians who wanted to attend that school?
But Barry, I think it's much deeper than that. In other words, the problem down here is it's like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, there's an outrage here, a protest there, a scandal over there, and you have lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. Unfortunately, in more cases than most of them, the good side has won. Mm. But often people fail to realize the depth of the opposition. So I would say we've got to understand what we're facing. The French Revolution only lasted 10 years in France. But like a volcanic explosion, the lava flow have flowed out ever since. Three main lava flows. The main one everyone knows about was communism, designed in the 19th century, came out in the 20th, Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. But what we're facing is a different lava flow, not classical communism, but cultural Marxism. And that goes back to Antonio Gramsci in the 1920s in jail in Italy, picked up by the Frankfurt School and became very, very important in this country when the radicals in the 60s called for a long march through the institutions. In other words, they wanted to win slowly the colleges, universities, the press and the media, Hollywood and entertainment, and then sweep round and win the country. Well, you can see that 50 years later, they have done it. And now you have woke business and woke military. Now, when you see the ideology, it's very stark in America, because the ideas from the American Revolution, which were actually rooted in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, when they're contrasted with the ideas in the French Revolution, they are night and day in difference. So it's not just a matter of a lawsuit here and a lawsuit there, and victory here and a victory there. We're up against an entirely different ideology. Everything seen in terms of oppressors and victims. And in terms of that, obviously, religious freedom, which gives freedom for the Christian faith, freedom for Judaism, freedom for every religion. It is the source of their principal opposition. And so they ban it. It's a very, very deep divide. And while we need all the lawsuits we can use, we've got to see that the difference is far, far deeper and more radical than just that.
So then it raises the question, how do we deal with it? How do we even communicate? Like, I'm concerned that at this point, it's almost like we can't even communicate with one another because of these very deep differences.
Well, we can, because we're human beings, and good persuasion, good in Christian terms, apologetics, makes that possible. But we've got to see that it's rather like, you remember Moses or Elijah or Abraham Lincoln in the 19th century. Great leaders define reality for a nation and set up the choice that's the core of what the nation must face. So Abraham Lincoln, America cannot remain half slave, half free. And he quotes Jesus, a kingdom divided against, house divided against itself cannot stand.
Right.
Moses did the same. I put before you life and death, blessing, choose life. Now, we've got to do that here. So too many Americans are missing it altogether. They're playing whack-a-mole. But there's no end to the protests they'll have to do. You need a leader. Now, the trouble is in Canada, you have a woke leader under Mr. Trudeau. But a good leader would say, Canada, Britain, the US, you've got to choose. Do you want a free society, a genuine democracy, or not? And if we go woke, that's the end of the American Republic. That's the end of genuine Canadian and English democracy.
Yeah, and the struggle then is trying to figure out, okay, so how do we approach this when you don't have leadership, as you articulated? What then is the role of the public at large trying to make sense of this experience that we're all going through, because it is very polarizing, and we see that in spades right now in Canada, where the country is definitely becoming more polarized as time goes on because of the policies that are being made, and including the redefinition of terms. The whole language itself is being challenged. And so then how do we go about for those who are of the conservative and certainly religious mind, being a, and when I say religious mind, I have to be, clear that, as a Judeo-Christian society that, of course, a lot of people dispute today, which is quite phenomenal, because when you look at all of our history and our heritage, that was indeed the reality. But nevertheless, how do we ensure that there is freedom for everyone? How do we ensure that we get to a sense of equilibrium again? Because right now, it's certainly all one-sided.
No, absolutely. No. In Canada, your prime minister has gone woke himself. So You need good opposition leaders who don't just attack some of the details of what he says, but give you a totally alternative vision of a free society. So I've argued in America, I'm not American, as you know, I argue for a civil public square. And that's in direct contrast on the one hand to, on the one hand, a naked public square where no religion's allowed in at all, or a sacred public square where one religion or another is established, like the Church of England in England or Islam in the Near East or whatever. I would argue for a civil public square where people of every faith, based on freedom of conscience, are free to enter public life, engage public life, and argue for the policies they want, even those that come directly from their faith. But they have to be persuasive, because religious freedom shifted the language of politics from coercion, which is typical where you had a state church, to persuasion. You have to win the right to your policy by persuading enough people to support you, and so on. So I'm a great champion of the so-called civil public square.
Mm. And of course, a lot of people would look at this and, there's a discussion going on right now, as it does appear within Western civilizations, there is at least within a within those civilizations, those countries, a kind of a rising up of a more populist, conservative type of feeling, of sentiment. And there is always a concern, of course, that you listen to the news reports and all the rest, and everyone's frightened to death about the populace coming up in Canada. There was a big uprising a few years ago with the Trucker Freedom Convoy. And the Prime Minister, of course, tried to demonize it, and the press tried to demonize it. But from my observation, there was a real sense of, okay, we are to rise up. It was a nonviolent approach, very, very much so. And but there was also a religious element to it, which I thought was fascinating. But there is this, a kind of like a bit of a rebirth going on right now in society. I think people are starting to realize that these, the current policies of the woke mindset is not making people happier. In fact, it's creating an us and a them, and is creating a lot of division. And so a lot of people would say, well, Mr. Guinness, you're the civil public square, but the civil public square is really just simply another name for a movement that was there in the past, and we've gone past that, and we don't need those old ideas. But at the end of the day, is what we have now going to help us at all?
Well, you're right to point out the chasm between the elites and the populace, but we can't just be on the populist side. In other words, thank God for the pushback. I was supportive of your truckers, or say the farmers taking on Prime Minister Rutte in Holland and so on. But we've got to see that that gap between the elites and the populace, the so-called forgotten people that Mr. Trump speaks to, or Nigel Farage in England led in terms of Brexit, or Giorgia Meloni in Italy, or Marine Le Pen in France. It's a very significant movement, but you can't just support one side or the other. If we're to have democracy, there's got to be a healing. And I'm challenging the elites. They say they're, quote, saving democracy, often when they're killing it. They make no attempts to reach out to those they've alienated, and they call them, like Hillary Clinton, the deplorables and so on, as an incredible disdain among the elites for ordinary people, which is absolutely shameful in Western society and so-called democratic societies. Now, you're right, a civil public square isn't here today, and actually I doubt it's been there for quite a while. I personally think civility by itself is kind of like the Maginot Line before World War II. Hitler, with his blitzkrieg, just went round it and invaded France and took it over. And in the same way, civility by itself will never hold the tide back. You know, we certainly need truth, respect, persuasion, but by themselves, they will not do it. There's got to be a fundamental choice. Do you want a free society, or do you want to go the way of the radical left? And what I say, if you look, and remember, I grew up, Barry, my first 10 years were in China. So I was there during the first 2 years of the Reign of Terror under Mao Zedong. So I would say, if you look at the history of the left, from the French Revolution down through the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, and all the color revolutions, the revolutions of the left never succeed. The oppressions of the left never end. And the promises of the left never happen. But America and Canada and Britain have got to choose. Do they want to go woke, or do they want to go back to what free democracy means? Now, we've got to show people what that means in practice. But there's got to be a fundamental choice, and certainly you need that in Canada.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then I guess it requires a fair amount of courage of people to stand up and say, hey, here's the fundamental choice. And we're finding that there's very few of those people who are willing to risk speaking in the public that side of the fundamental choice, or even just raising the issue for fear of being sideswiped, saying, well, no, you're just pushing your white man's privileged position to the public at large, and we had enough of that. So there is that element of needing to be courageous to get out there and be like Teddy Roosevelt said, be the man in the arena.
No, absolutely. My son always gives me that quotation. It's not the critic who counts. It's the man in the arena. Now, that's why the Greeks put courage as the first virtue, because every other virtue you need requires at least courage in order to practice it against those who don't care about it. So certainly we need courage today. But I think when you take on the woke, you've got to know why and how they come after you. You mentioned white privilege and all that sort of stuff. We need to know what their thinking is that leads them to that and how wrong it really is. Now, I speak as a follower of Jesus. And you certainly need courage. As he said, pick up your cross and follow me. Otherwise, everything that contradicts something that stands between him and his call has to go. And that requires courage. So it's certainly, I mentioned Abraham Lincoln. He paid with his life for his stand. And we need people who have courage today, but challenge themselves and then people around them to make that choice. Are we serious about free societies? Then there's only certain ways you can build them. And we've got to really expose and challenge the left.
So if we were to look at a blueprint forward, what would that include? What would be the steps that you would suggest to our listeners today that, hey, listen, you want a free country, you want a free Canada, you want a free US, you want a free UK. What would that include? What would it look like?
Well, you've got to look at what is the basis of real freedom. And for me, I'm fascinated with the fact that, you know, if you look at the history of the Christian church, when the Christian faith became the official religion of Rome in 380. It made, I think, the great mistake of copying Roman structures. And the structures politically of Rome were hierarchical. A Caesar, consuls, senators, and you had a pope and cardinals and bishops. And it was a Catholic layman, Lord Acton, the great champion of freedom, who made the famous remark, all power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that remark he made about his own church. Hierarchical structures are oppressive and abusive. Now, the Reformation, though, when it went back to the Bible, sola scriptura, went to ask, what was God's way of politics? It wasn't hierarchical. And you look in Exodus and Deuteronomy, it is covenantal. And that became a ferment of ideas in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And many of the greatest modern ideas of freedom came out of that, including the consent of the governed and things like that. So I think we've got to go back to say, what is freedom? Where do you find the greatest roots of a realistic, balanced freedom with justice and so on? Now, for me, I call it the once and future discussion. Because when you discover these roots, you're looking at some of the best of our past, but we're also looking ahead. Because if the West declines further and there's no reawakening of Western civilization, we're going into an extraordinary, challenging world of autocracy, authoritarianism, when we need to know, how do we fight for a human-friendly future? Human dignity, words, truth, freedom, justice, peace. How do you ground these things? That's what I'm challenging citizens to do and Christians to do. And I think the deepest answers, I'm not being pious here, you find them in Exodus and Deuteronomy.
Okay. And then, so in essence, what I'm hearing you say, the importance of understanding the covenantal relationship between man and God, but also between man and man, right? It's the Christ's two greatest commandments that we need to be following. We love God with all our heart, but we also love our fellow man as ourselves. So there's this vertical relationship, horizontal relationship that we see, for example, in Deuteronomy 6, but and then teaching those virtues on to our children. So there is this requirement that within our own household that we, in essence, have that civil public square as well, right at the at its beginning, perhaps.
No, you're absolutely right, Barry. I mean, I love the fact what the rabbis point out. You know, the night of the Passover, 430 years of slavery. Tonight, they're going free. Mm. Moses never mentions freedom. Where are they going? To the promised land, the land of milk and honey. He never mentions it. But three times, Moses talks about children. Because the story we tell to our children will be the key to their continuity and their identity, rather, and the continuity of faith. And so you're right to begin in the family. It's got to begin in families above all, and then churches and synagogues and schools. And those are the seed beds of free society. And if they are attacked and undermined, all freedoms will go. It's not just a matter of politics. You've got to begin in the seed bed above all in the family.
And then as we move forward into a very strange kind of society that the elite seem to be preparing for us with all of the discussions of artificial intelligence and how all of that's going to affect everyone. As you look back over the years and you saw your own life and your own experiences in the sense of growing up in the, you know, after World War II and all of that, you would have seen, no doubt. Well, I mean, you like you said, you grew your first 10 years in China, but when you would have went back to, I assume you went back to the UK after China?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you would have seen an awful lot of runes in the various cities throughout the UK, and picking up from that kind of cataclysmic event, I wonder if we're not in for another. I mean, I think we're all kind of going through some cataclysm of certainly in our culture, and repairing it and giving people the encouragement to get back to the basics. How do we? Okay, so we do it in our families and all the rest. But is there any personal disciplines or something that you would say, hey, here's a to-do list?
But Barry, when you said the future, the elite's preparing for us, you were part of the elite with your podcast. You know, in other words, we've got to challenge the elites that we disagree with. And I just make one point. If you go back 30 years, I, you know, lived in Oxford just a few yards from Richard Dawkins. And moving to Washington, I met Christopher Hitchens. Right. If you look at the new atheists of that time, they were stridently anti-religious. How religion poisons everything, Christopher Hitchens. Now, you compare that today, when you have many of the leading thinkers like Douglas Murray, Tom Holland, Neil Ferguson, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Jordan Peterson, your Canadian, they realize that faith, the Jewish and Christian faiths, are indispensable to the West, and to throw them out is absolute folly. And so there's a completely different climate. Or put it another way, you can look at Enlightenment secularism, which, rather like Napoleon crowning himself, sort of announced it was godlings on planet Earth, as Yuval Harari put it.
Right.
But you can see the problems of secularism. It's rampant, the problems today. Mm. We've got to remind people, you cannot live without faith. What supplies meaning and belonging and purpose? If you try and ground them anywhere but in true faith, you end up with an ideology which is semi-religious and very dangerous.
Mm.
And so we're actually at a very good moment to press back, to call for the deepest choice, and to articulate the great alternatives of the Jewish and Christian faith again. This is a great moment if we seize it. It won't happen. I don't believe in Neil Howe, the cycles. History is not cyclical. Humans are made free, so we're not fated, or we're not like the secularists, determined. But we've got to exercise that freedom responsibly.
Okay, this is really cool. So I love that, the whole idea about seizing the moment. And we have to, I guess, through the wilderness, through the fog that we see currently going on in our society at large, we're nevertheless able to get those gems of sanity that, as those individuals you just mentioned, Douglas Murray, Peterson, and so on, to say, hey, you know what? Let's step back and say, you know, enough is enough. We need that civil public square, and we need to take the personal responsibility to obtain it.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Yes.
No. And I would just mention that if you look, what makes a free society? You've got to begin with high human worth. And yeah, there's nowhere you find that except in Genesis 1. Humans are made in the image and likeness of God. We're not just animals. We're certainly not machines. We're not algorithms in bodies. We are made in the image and likeness of God. So beginning there, I mentioned truth. In the postmodern age where everything's reduced to power, truth is incredibly important. Solves on its end. One word of truth outweighs the entire world. Or freedom, the difference between a biblical understanding of freedom and all the specious forms around today is night and day. Mm-hmm. And go on down the line. I don't know about Canada, But here in America at the moment, the big divide is justice. There's no question both sides are right, that there is injustice. But what the radical left does, you remember they analyze everything, oppressor, victim. They have no truth, only power. So they set up a conflict of powers. Now, the Romans are very clear. If you only have power, you can only have peace if you have the peace of despotism. In other words, a power so powerful it can put down every other power. But that's authoritarianism. That's totalitarianism. And that's the way of the radical left. Now, the biblical view, Jewish and Christian, you address truth to power. And you call for that about turn of heart and mind that is repentance. And you can have forgiveness, freeing the past, opening up a future of a second chance, and achieving genuine reconciliation. You know, as the rabbis said, for many people, the hero is the man who can conquer his enemies. No, no, said the rabbis, the hero is the man who can turn his enemy into a friend through reconciliation. And you can see night and day's difference between the left-wing view of tackling injustice and the Jewish and Christian view. And they come out in entirely different places.
Mm-hmm. Very, very powerful. And it's those very basic concepts. It takes me back to various ideas of the great authors, including of the 20th century. I think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who recognized that as well in his own heart. And it was this sense of, you know what, we are all tarred, you know, the line between good and evil runs through every human heart. It's kind of like, you know what, we need to understand this basic understanding of mankind. And recognize the answer to the riddle of man's search for meaning is that which we have already had in our past, but has been gotten away, and i.e. what we had in our past, as you point out, the Judeo-Christian understanding of what it means to be human, which we have forgotten.
And well, Barry, and I love the fact that's one of the big differences between the Jewish and Christian faiths and the left. The Jewish and Christian faiths are realistic. So the notion of the separation of powers or checks and balances, which you have strongly here, came through the Presbyterians down through John Witherspoon to James Madison. Why? Because humans are sinful. They will abuse each other if they have too much power. Whereas the left is utopian.
Yes.
Has always been utopian from Jean-Jacques Rousseau onwards. And whenever there's a gap between the real and the ideal, well, you try and bridge the gap through force, violence, coercion. So the left is always disastrous because it doesn't have a realistic view of humanity.
Right.
And you could go on down the line. The differences are terribly important, and they're playing out now in spades.
What would you suggest to our listeners today if you were to give them an assignment to do or to read? What works would you say, hey, you know what? In order for us to get back to our civil public square, here's what I would recommend.
Golly Moses, take a little course to do it. You know, I've tried to put some of these things in one of my own books called The Magna Carta of Humanity, because it's a description of how the Jewish foundations for these things were there in the Bible, but they've been lost. Now, I would challenge people to read, say, Isaiah Berlin or Solzhenitsyn, Hume mentioned, or Lord Acton, these great thinkers of freedom. So I happened to be at Oxford with Isaiah Berlin. And you know his famous distinction, freedom is not only negative, freedom from. Nobody is free if they're under any oppression at all, the control of someone else, whether it's a dictator or drugs or alcohol. They're not free. You need negative freedom, freedom from. Freedom starts with being set free. But, and here's where Isaiah Berlin was profound, you need positive freedom, freedom for, freedom to be. Now, for that, you need truth. What are we supposed to be? Are we made in the image of God, or are we animals, or are we machines? You've got to know the truth of who we are in order to be free as who we are. So it's these great thinkers who put it out. Now, I don't know about Canada, but in America, the average view of freedom is doing what you like, the permission to do what you like. And Lord Acton would say, no, 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 that's license. Freedom is the power to do what you ought. Or I put it, you know, we love the Greek phrase, Socrates, the unexamined life is not worth living. But I would add to that the great Hebrew maxim, the uninstructed life is not worth living. Mm-hmm. Because freedom is not do whatever you like. That leads to chaos. Freedom, like playing a piano or playing a violin or learning a great sport, is the discipline and practice of maturing in whatever you're doing. And that's true of freedom. Freedom is a moral endeavor. And we need to challenge people to think of it realistically if we're going to be free. Well, Barry, put it another way. You know, the most famous American definition of democracy, people would quote Lincoln: government of the people, by the people, for the people. But Americans forget Lincoln was quoting a pastor, but the pastor was quoting John Wycliffe from the 14th century. And what Wycliffe was arguing wonderfully, if we put the Bible in the hands of ordinary people, and it was not just the clergy like the church was doing then, if we put the Bible in the hands of ordinary people, it will make possible self-government. Government of the people, by the people, for the people. They will have the tools and all that it takes to be free people.
Because they have an understanding of their responsibility. They have a understanding and philosophical understanding what it means to be human, that we're actually sinful in our nature, that we need grace, we need forgiveness, we need repentance, all of those great understandings that we have absolutely thrown out in our current culture. And that was the bedrock, because we could trust people. We could trust the banker. We could trust the lawyer. We could trust the priest or the pastor. We could trust everyone who claimed and understood and were disciplined. And I love that. This idea of being instructed. We have lost that in so many areas. And I would say, including our institutions. And while there's been this march of the institutions, we've seen that as that march has continued, people no longer have any trust in the institutions.
No, you're exactly. I mean, just take one element, which to me is one of the central elements, postmodernism. If you look at thinkers like Michel Foucault and others, truth is dead. That goes back actually to Friedrich Nietzsche in the 1880s. But if truth is dead, all you have is power. Yeah. Now, when you have a high truth society, you can have a high trust society. And high trust will always be high freedom. But when you have no truth, you have low trust and no freedom. You have to have, for example, surveillance cameras. And that's why a country like China has 2 billion surveillance cameras. Zero trust. Or Solzhenitsyn said of the Soviet people, their worldview was suspicion. In other words, under postmodernism, if everything's power, Barry, I don't know what you're doing to me. You've got some agenda, I don't know. Your interests are not my interests. I've got to be suspicious of you. You know, the philosophical term for that is the hermeneutics of suspicion. But put simply, everyone needs to be suspicious if they're not to be a sucker. Now, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Because you'll have no trust and you'll have no freedom. So some of these things are actually incredibly simple, mathematically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
lose this and you lose that, and so on. But again, we've got to get people to see the big choice. Do they want freedom? You can't have it if you go that way. So your prime minister and all the wokeism in Canada spells disaster for Canada.
And it's a disaster that we're living in real time, no question about it.
No, that's right.
You know, I just want to thank you so very much for being with us here on this. It's just so powerful. It's evident that you have thought long and hard on these subjects, and certainly you have given so much of your career in writings, and I have a number of them and appreciate them. Where can people find more about your work and your social media? Do you have social media? Where can people find you on the net?
Well, I'm not much on social media, I must admit. But you can see my website at ozguinness.com.
Okay, excellent. And then there would be all kinds of information for where people can access your books and so forth. That's great. Well, okay, I thank you so very much for being with us tonight. And is there anything else that you would like to share as a final thought for people living in the West, going through this this time? Do we have hope?
Of course. You know, our family motto in the Guinness family, going back several hundred years, is Spes Mea in Deo. My hope is in God. But let me put it like this. When I was a boy, 10, under the Chinese communists, my brothers had died in a famine. We lived in war, famine, revolution, violence. It was incredible. But I never saw my parents' faith waver once in the goodness of God in all that horrific circumstances. And looking back, I would put my father's attitude like this. God is greater than all. God can be trusted in all situations. Have faith in God. Have no fear. So we're living in a tumultuous time with the crisis of the West and the crisis of our individual countries. But we should never fear. We have the best news ever, good news of the gospel, and we should go out with courage and demonstrate the alternatives that truly are the best news.
Great. Well, thank you so very much, Oz. It's been an absolute privilege and pleasure to hear you speak tonight. I love having this hope and recognizing the state that we're in is not forever, and that it's up to us to make that positive choice. So thanks again.
Thank you. My privilege.
The fight for freedom consists not only in the legal battles in court, but also in the battle of ideas at the universities and in the media. It takes time, effort, and money to keep on top of the debates for freedom. Your donation allows us to keep fighting for all Canadians. firstfreedoms.ca.